Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
That we've had for discussion on the podcast, and we came across one that's just back pain.
I don't want to do this
one. It's so nondescript and such a blanket diagnosis.
Oh.
But, you know, when it's especially, you can tell that it's too general of a diagnosis because when 85% of people have this thing.
Wait. Let's talk about that right there. It's like what percentage of human beings that have walked the planet have back pain? It's 100%.
All of them.
It's like, I love that though. It's like, because ever since I graduated from physical therapy school before you were born, it's like the percentage has slowly climbed. It's like when people talk about it, it's like they throw out this blanket percentage of like 70% of the people that lived on the planet have had back pain. It's like, and now it's up to the mid 80s. It's like, let's just say 100.
Come on.
Everybody's had it at least once. Okay. Let's just, okay. And then yours is not the same as his, nor hers, or mine, or theirs. Okay. And so there's no blanket protocol to resolve your low back pain. You know, there's no one diagnosis that would lead to it. There is not necessarily a structural reason for it. So right away, we are all over the place in regards to why you may have back pain.
Yeah.
So that's what makes it a difficult topic to talk about.
If you spend any time looking at the potential side effects of a medication, back pain is almost always on that list. So it's like, if there is any distress to your digestive system, if you have any type of inflammation in your abdomen or pelvis area at all, it's going to refer pain to your back and probably other spots too. It's like,
well, and then is there a physiological consequence that leads to a mechanical diagnosis, right?
Sure.
It's like, so again, we're back to square one of not wanting to talk about this at
all. Or even worse, you have some nondescript symptom that's in an area that's diagnosed as your back. And then someone makes the decision to send you for imaging, and then your imaging comes back as you have a bulging disc and herniations at this level, this level. And they want to just use this structural reductionist approach and say, here's the reason.
Yeah.
I'm a surgeon that practices this type of laminectomy or fusion, and we'll sign you up for one in 6 weeks, and you'll be totally better, or maybe not.
Or
if
maybe
you're not better, then I'll just say it's not my fault and we'll move you on to the next. We'll just shoot you with an epidural and you'll just be on a regimen of shots for the rest of your life. Steroid injections and
it's like you look at organ, like the internal organs have areas that it would refer. It's like, folks that have had a heart attack, they know like, oh, it's a jaw thing or a neck thing or a shoulder thing that you get referred pain from there. It's like, well, kidneys will refer pain to certain areas of your back. It's like, as an example, it's like, so that has to be ruled out in certain circumstances.
Yeah.
Horrible ones, cancer. It's like, you misdiagnose that, you know, that's a toughie.
Yeah.
There's a gajillion reasons why your back may hurt.
It's a big lesson in never throw out. If you have a certain toolbox, it's hard to not have the bias of, you know, if you only have screwdrivers and hammers and everything looks like nails and screws. So it's you got to remember that there could always be a medical reason. We've done a case study with one of my athletes who had like an autoimmune disorder The things that we had done over time for his movement stuff helped his SI joint pain and helped his retrosternal pain just through better movement through space. But he always had these lingering sensations that never seemed to go away until he went on the autoimmune drugs because he had this, you know, autoimmune disorder. So it's there.
Yeah.
trying to come to some type of conclusion and focal point about what people are experiencing. A lot, and a lot of instances where someone has an acute event and they need to go to see a physical therapist or a doctor, they've typically strained something through movement. They've tried to do something. They've exceeded their capacity to do, to move in a certain way. They've exceeded their ability to exert force in compression in a certain position. And that leads to some give at something structurally.
Potentially.
Potentially. And then you have a pain response based on you exceeding this capacity. But it's even then, it's hard to just say that that's what's happening, because it could be a myriad.
Right. Let me just say this. I think that the biomechanical sources might be one of the easier things to rule in or rule out.
Sure. Okay.
Right. Yeah. And so that's why looking at it from the biomechanical perspective becomes so helpful, because, you know, if we want to get into the sciencey part of you know, pain and such, it's like, okay, we've got this representative model of, you know, the neurosignatures and the biopsychosocial element of it. Don't forget the bio part for those of you that are learning that aspect of things. It's like that becomes one of the stronger representations of why people would have these scenarios. Whether it be structural or not, there can be biomechanical behaviors that lead to the diagnostic, you know, lower back pain thing, right? Too much pressure in one place, too much tension in one place can be perceived as something of interest to the system, and then you pay attention to that, and then that might lead to something that we would describe as pain. So under those circumstances, if we have somebody that has sacrificed the relative movement that we would typically associate with the capacity to move well and move effectively, where we would not have the prolonged pressures and tensions that might produce pain, that might be one of these ways that we can start to rule out these biomechanical reasons for somebody to have their diagnosis of low back pain.
Sure. So yeah, I think of a way to state this from the biomechanics movement perspective. So as I'm moving through space, if I'm distributing forces throughout my body in order to continue to propel myself forward through space, there are turns that are happening in an alternating fashion in order to create straight line movement. So I have superimposition of turning happening.
Correct.
When that doesn't work in a way, in a relative motion scenario, it doesn't allow for the energy to propagate up and down the body as it should in sort of like a wave.
Well, it's not distributed. If it's distributed or sort of diluted, if you will, right? Like from a magnitude standpoint, that would be that. So that's what relative motion does. So we talked about this from a performance perspective, where like at a high performing level, if I have to produce high force and high velocities, I will orient, because it allows those forces to be produced. Because relative motion would either dampen or dissipate that energy and not allow the performance related outcome to be demonstrated. Take it. And this is why the health and performance continuum faces, like, it's a circle that faces itself at the top, right? It's like on one side I've got performance, on the other side I have health, and they are literally on the other side of the line. It's not the two ends of the spectrum that are represented. It's like dead center, where if I cross over this way, I potentially have greater health. If I go across this way, I potentially have higher performance. And so I have to take that into consideration because from a performance standpoint. But if I have that same representation that I would use for performance, and I'm trying to behave in a lower force atmosphere or environment, and I use a high performance strategy or I use an orientation strategy, now I'm actually increasing the degree of load over a more prolonged period of time. And that might be the source. So if I have somebody with a, with an increase in the internal rotation through the spine, that is a compressive strategy. That is a reduction in relative motion that would reduce my ability to dampen forces that would be going through certain structures. In this case, we would say the lumbar spine, if we're going to pick on an area for low back pain.
Yeah. I mean, it's so pain and tweaking something and muscle strains, a lot of that comes from pushing on the ground, trying to put force down into the ground and not being able to attain the shapes that are necessary for internal rotation and force production.
Yeah. Efficiently.
Efficiently. So I'm not able to organize my joints and place them in such a orientation that allows for this distributed force throughout my body. Yeah. So there's a weak link in that chain reaction, basically, that leads to increased tension and force going through one area without the ability to distribute it up and downstream. And then I get some type of give.
Yeah. So consider that, again, let's pick on the lumbar spine itself. So if I have five separate segments in the lumbar spine as bone, like the bones, the vertebrae, they should move relative to one another. Is it a lot? Not necessarily, but that motion should be there because, again, for the strategies that we're talking about before to dampen the amount of stress that would be going through that area, that relative motion is useful for it, right? But if I jam those five segments together and they start behaving as a single segment, now you don't have an efficient distribution of that energy and it becomes more focal local, which means that now maybe this turns into zygapophyseal arthropathy, or I put too much pressure on the bones that supply the nutrition to the disc, and now I evolve a disc-related pathology, right? Something doesn't move that is supposed to move, and that increases the amount of energy that area absorbs, and there is a consequence to that. So it could turn into something structural. It may be the precursor to something structural, right? I mean, to use an example, like if you sit on a really hard chair long enough, your butt starts to hurt, okay? That would be more of like an ischemic response. So it's a reduction in blood flow. Your receptors send that message to the brain. The brain goes, hey, there's no blood flow in this area. I got a message that says that we need to get blood flow back into that. I need you to get up. And you go, but I'm working. I'm going to stay here on the chair. I'm going to work through this. And the brain finally goes, look, this is turning into a bad situation. I really need you to get up. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make this hurt now, and it's going to make you get up, right? And so then you get up and you take the pressure off your butt. But what if you're in a scenario where the compensatory strategy that you have to use because of your physical structure, the activities that you've chosen in your lifetime, the activity that you're performing right now, does not allow you to make that change. And now you have a situation where you can't alleviate that pressure and tension. And then that's where people start walking around. They go, man, every morning I feel the same thing. And then that thing that happens every morning starts to last longer and longer throughout the day. And then now it's lasting into late in the day. And now it's turning into like this chronicity of, wow, I really can't do anything like I used to. I need to go to see someone to see what is wrong with me.
Right. So it's a continued and sustained tension. It's an increase in compression that's going to rob you of options for movement.
Right.
So you only the options you have to move are more and more limited.
Yeah.
You end up putting pressure on the same structures continuously, which is going to rob them of blood flow and create some type of ischemic response that's going to lead to your body being like, hey, do something about this.
Yeah. So like if you've ever gone to Disney World and you stand in line for a ride for 3 hours and your back starts to bother you, you finally get on the ride and you sit down and you go, oh, my back pain is fine. It's like, what did you just do? Well, chances are you had a little bit of an ischemic response because you were in a position for an extended period of time. There was a reduction in blood flow. You recognize that. And then you sit down and then it changes the position and it restores the blood flow to that area. Guess what? It's like, that is a representation of what we're talking about. But what if that What if that scenario was prolonged? Now you're going to go further and further into a compromise of where I'm eventually going to give up some movement capabilities potentially. And now you have this, like I said, this chronic representation of a lack of movement, a chronic representation of reduction in blood flow. And then there is a secondary consequence to that. And so this is going to be an inability to feed hyaline cartilage at the ends of bones in the spine, the inability to get nutrition to a disc. And now the disc slowly weakens over time. And then there is a larger consequence that can follow those
things. Yeah, another thing I wanted to touch on was the increase of movement at the lumbar spine, mm-hmm. where we see a lot of compensations and faking of movements by turning, big turns taking place at the lumbar spine in order uh-huh. to make up for a lack of relative movements in other places. Yeah. I guess you could consider it a strong overuse case of the lower back. So there's lots of motion has to come from the lumbar spine, where normally you would want to have these motions be distributed through the hips and knees and ankles. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Instead, there's big turns happening over and over again.
Yeah.
It's like the concept of you take like a metal bar and you bend it back and forth enough times, it's eventually going to break.
Right. Well, this is why you get the associations of they say, well, if you have enough hip range of motion, it tends to help with your back pain. Well, yes, it does, because you're again, this goes back to the concept of distributed energy. Right. It's like, instead of having these focal local situations, instead of having all of your segments moving as a single entity, right? This is what the distributed load does from a blood flow standpoint, from a structural consequence standpoint, for sure. Right. But it's understanding, it's like, oh, all of these things have to move relative. Like the femur has to move relative to the innominate. The innominate has to move relative to the sacrum. The sacrum has to move relative to the spine. Each segment of the spine has to move relative to the other segments. That would be more representative of the potential for health in regards to movement, right? And we take that away, and then once again, we're talking about the consequences of such.
You got back pain. I think, mm-hmm. understand. So if we're going to say that the biomechanical aspects are something that are easy to rule out, let's get into that a little bit. Let's talk about how you can rule out the biomechanical stuff, like who
can
you
we
should
air
see.
Quote the easy part?
Simple, easy, not as complex. Like, I don't know. Yeah.
Well, you get,
don't want to say
you
easy.
Get into the psychosocial aspects of it, and then that's a pickle that we don't want to deal with right now. The biomechanical viewpoint. If you think about the extremes, so take away all relative motions, restore relative motions, we would want to bias ourselves towards recapturing. We just want to be able to distribute energy, and then that way we can eliminate these focal local forces and tensions, right? And like, now the strategy to achieve that is very broad depending on the scenario. But if you are uncertain, the next best thing to do is to seek the help of an individual that has a reputation and a capability of actually helping you identify what the limitations are, you know, in this circumstance. And so this becomes your friendly neighborhood physical therapist, chiropractor, movement guy.
Right. Well, that's whatever it may be. I want to clarify what proper treatment looks like in this scenario, because a lot of times people will take the step, the important step of going to see someone mm-hmm. who may seem qualified, but the level of care that they're going to get is going to vary dramatically.
Well, yes, that is the unfortunate circumstance.
They may go somewhere where they have a chronic issue with their lower back, where they are mm-hmm. going to be met with ice packs, ultrasound, and heat packs.
Yeah, I would hope that's not too prolific as it used to be.
I think you're too far outside of what is normal.
Is it really?
Bill lives in a different universe.
I don't even know if you can bill for ultrasound anymore.
I'm pretty sure. I get referred people all the time that this is their experience.
But see, here's the really important thing about ultrasound treatments, because what they do is they give you 6 full minutes to try to figure out something that's going to be useful.
Sure, but okay. Well, I'll clarify then.
It's like a 20-minute hot pack. Put a 20-minute hot pack on somebody. It's like that's brilliant. It's like it gives me 20 minutes to try to
throw it. That's what they're using. It's in isolation. I'm talking about these are the only things you're being met with for treatment. So I want to elaborate a little bit more. Make sure you're going to see someone who's actually going to evaluate how you move, what your ranges of motions are, to give you a baseline that they can then check and recheck as you progress through your care with them.
Yes.
That's a huge point to make for anyone that's going. If you're seeing a chiropractor and they do the whole pop, snap, and whip thing with you, and then they just send you on your way, they aren't checking anything afterwards. They aren't checking anything before. They aren't giving you any type of interventions to use on your own or paying attention to your daily activities. Mm-hmm. These are things that should be red flags for you. It's like you want to make sure you're seeing a practitioner that's taking this wide perspective that we're talking about, eliminating the biomechanical aspects of it. And if they can't move the dial from a biomechanics point, not having you just come back for the same treatment every time in hopes that it gets better, but actually sending you potentially somewhere else to find maybe the root problem.
Many symptoms resolve over time. Symptoms resolve over time. Movement, not necessarily. Like if you move further in, if you move further into a compensatory strategy, you can actually resolve symptoms.
Yeah, I can create an orientation strategy to get rid of a symptom.
Right, but that doesn't solve the problem. And it's difficult. Like this is not an easy thing, you know. And I default to, word of mouth goes a long way in this scenario. It's not about questioning someone's intelligence. It's a matter of experiences, right? It's like going to, all due respect, I was a first year practitioner at one point, and I would not have sent anybody to me. Right now, like now, me knowing me back then, 34 years ago, there's no way I would have let me touch anybody. But legally, like I earned my license, right? I didn't know anything, and I did help some people by getting people moving. But I was a young skull full of mush that probably didn't know enough, you know, to save the world. But and in some cases that is still useful. It's like it's a better strategy than not doing something about it. But making sure somebody has some measure of requisite experience, and it's not about just time served. It's about, like I said, usually you can talk to other people. Like you've got friends and associates that have had good experiences with other practitioners. That's actually not a terrible way to start. You just got to be really, really careful that they're not just talking about a nice person. You got to make sure that they had a favorable outcome, right? Because it's very common for me to be like the fifth or sixth person that somebody has seen with a chronic problem. And they say, oh, I had a great whatever, chiropractor, therapist, you know, movement guy. And the next question is like, oh, so they resolved your problem. You say, well, no, but they were really good. It's like, okay, wait a minute. So what are you associating with this? Like, oh, what you're saying is like, you liked them. They were probably very kind to you, right? And you don't want to say anything bad about them. But the reality is, it's like you didn't get a resolution of your problem. So it's a tough thing to do. But again, usually it's a place to start.
Right. So circling back, kind of coming full circle to wrap it up here, there are a lot of different reasons why back pain could be happening. We mentioned the biopsychosocial aspects of things. The biomechanical aspects are easy to check and to eliminate as potential reasons. The movement behaviors, the relative motions versus orientations, the ranges of motion that you can measure, the dynamic tests that you can do as watching someone move through space, all of these things can be evaluated in order to rule out a biomechanical reasoning for your pain. Mm-hmm. So that's where we're telling people to start. We're trying to give examples of like what a good version of that would be, seeing a practitioner, what a less than good version of that would be, seeing a practitioner. And it's going to be kind of left up to, instead of us trying to tell you like where back, the definitive reason and the definitive place that back pain comes from.
Right.
Any other closing thoughts from Bill
on the topic that we didn't want to talk about? Was good. And it's like everybody wants the solution, and it's very, very difficult to arrive at that. But a lot of this process is just elimination more than anything else. It's like reestablish your movement capabilities. It's like that's usually the best strategy to start with, because if it is biomechanical in nature, there's usually if you can even make it worse in some cases, it's like that points to something that would be more biomechanical or even structural, and then helps you eliminate, you know, the possibilities. But yeah, no, your wrap up was quite good. So we have not solved the problem, because it is a difficult problem to solve.
Well, it's impossible. If everyone has a thing, it can't be one reason
that's
why this thing is happening. That's the too long didn't read version of the podcast right there.
There you go. Don't show that first. Nobody will listen.
You can just
for the six that. People that are still listening. We don't want to chase them away in the first minute.
I want to know the name of everyone's like favorite radio station when they were growing up. You know, they were all like KLDR, the Rads, or something like
I've
that.
I've got two.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. The very first radio station that I ever called into was Q106. And I was living in West York, in York, Pennsylvania. Okay. And we would listen to Q106. I remember that very clearly. First rock and roll station I ever listened to, first station I ever called into with a request. And I requested, here you go, Saturday Night by the Bay City Rollers. That was the song that I requested. I remember it like it was yesterday. And it was Wild Bill was the DJ.
There is the radio station that my dad always wanted to listen to is Warm 101.3. It was a soft rock. So it was a lot of like Air Supply and Kenny G and Michael McDonald.
I'm all out of love.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now
that's considered yacht rock is what people like to call that, or like dad yacht? Rock. Yacht rock.
Like YACHT, like yacht?
A big boat.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. They call that yacht rock now.
That's one of the ones
that I remember very well. And then the one that I listened to because I was an edgy teenager was The Nerve 95.1, 95.5, The Nerve.
And what was that? What was that?
It was like an alternative rock, modern alternative rock station.
So it would be like REM and Nirvana?
Nirvana, definitely. Like Nirvana, Primus, Tool, Rage Against the Machine.
That's too vicious for me.
I can't alternative rock.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, I've listened to a lot of that. I'm trying to think of the other ones.
The other one, like, so when I moved to Indiana, then
Q95. Oh, and the other one was the pop music station in Rochester was 98 PXY. 97.9 was 98 PXY. That was like the pop music station, and that was anything popular at the time. So it was a lot of like, you know, hip hop and Britney Spears, NSYNC, boy band R&B.
I think Fort Wayne was WMEE.
Okay.
97.3.
Okay.
I think.
Yeah. So everyone will dip into everyone's nostalgia, and they can post their favorite childhood radio stations.
I don't know.
A lot of these stations even exist anymore? I don't even know.
I think WME is still around because they were overtaken by 98.9 The Bear in Fort Wayne.
Was that there's like a voiceover, some guy going The Bear, and then there's a bear roaring in the background. There's like a really crappy like sound effect of a bear.
98.9 The Bear.
All right.
WME was the Magic Me, I believe.
The Magic Me.